Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Pal Dybul about arsenic and old lace at the Santa Fe Playhouse. We're going to be speaking to Arthur Ian about a documentary called Looking for Romeo. And we will be speaking to Sleem about the Solstice Cabaret Show coming up in Madrid. Right now, I would like to welcome Bobby Heller. She is the executive director of Felines and Friends, doing a lot of animal stuff this week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte.
So this is, as we talked about with Bill Hutchison just yesterday, this is really an interesting time for cats. There's just more cat litter being born than ever.
It was a late season this year. We thought we had kind of made a dent in it in the last few years of sterilization, and then all of a sudden the kittens hit late in the season. We still have, and it's here it is, middle of December, and we have litters of kittens that are only now turning 10 to 12 weeks of age.
How old does a kitten have to be before it can leave its mother and be adopted?
We have to hold out till 8 weeks, which is what the shelters do too, and that's got to do with, it's better for the kittens, but also for vaccinations. And then we try to get them fixed before we place them. And most of the time we do, except when there's a health issue, that they need to wait a little bit. Otherwise, we do them when they hit 2 pounds, and that's typically 8 to 9 weeks.
A 2-pound cat can be neutered or spayed.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And so Felines and Friends, tell us a little bit about the organization.
The organization actually started in Los Angeles back in 1990, and when I moved here with my husband and 5 cats, we had no intention of having a chapter, but as it happens, there were stray cats living right where we had an office, and we started rescuing those, and then it was like, okay, there's more, and had to start the chapter of the organization here to be able to manage it.
You just can't help yourself.
No, I can't help myself.
And there's a big problem. I mean, I guess it really differs a lot from city to city, depending on how good the spay neuter programs are.
Absolutely. We are making strides here in northern New Mexico, but it has taken quite a few years, whereas other cities have been much more proactive for many more years, so they really don't have quite the level that we do here of the strays and the ferals. Every city has strays and ferals. I mean, you're not going to avoid that.
Now, a feral cat is it the same genetically as a domestic cat? It's just living on its own, or is it a different kind of cat?
The definition is it is a domestic cat who has not had human contact.
And so they behave differently. They're a whole different kind of creature to deal with.
Their survival instincts kick in because they don't trust humans.
Right. And so under what circumstances does a domestic cat find itself a feral cat? In other words, abandoned cats that then have litters?
Abandoned cats that have litters, or young abandoned cats who revert back to the survival mode, and then they keep having kittens. So in Los Angeles, we actually worked with a colony, and we had 3 generations.
Of feral cats.
Mm-hmm.
What's the circumstance of feral cats here?
There are some wild estimates that put it at almost 10,000, potentially 10,000 stray and feral cats in a city this small. That's quite astounding, and they somehow survive. They have horrendous problems at apartment buildings and mobile home parks, where they have not done a good job of insisting proof of sterilization for the pets that are moving in. And that's something we're trying to work with some of the mobile home parks to you know, if they did that step up front, then people wouldn't have the animals, and then they couldn't just move out and leave them behind.
Right. And that's what happens, and then that contributes to the problem.
Absolutely. And then you have reports of feral cats living under trailers, you know, 50 and 60 of them. And I talked to an animal control officer in the county about 2 weeks ago, and she said, I actually counted them. She said, this is not an exaggeration.
Living under one trailer.
Yeah, under 2 trailers, and they started trapping them.
And so what do you, let's stay with feral cats for a second. What do you, Felines and Friends, do about the feral cats problem?
Anybody who is feeding feral cats, who is willing to continue feeding them, provide them shelter, and be a part of the solution, we will provide them with traps and guidance on how to do this, and then set them up with taking them to the spay-neuter clinic, over next to Outback Steakhouse. That's from the shelter. And, you know, their rates are incredibly reasonable. There are other organizations who are not doing the facilitation, but they are doing the fundraising to pay for the sterilization. So we work together between all the organizations to help the situation. But the only people we can help are those who are willing to be part of the solution.
So they trap the cat, get it sterilized, and then send it back into its home under the trailer or wherever.
Right. And, you know, we tell people, look, you've got yourself a controlled colony who's serving as pest control, because Lord knows we have enough mice around this place.
Very much so. In fact, I need one of those in my house, except that the dog would eat it. But the when you have a feral cat, can it ever be domesticated?
We have. We're actually got some feral kittens now that were pulled from a cul-de-sac in a business industrial area. Mother had disappeared, and it was actually a culvert is where they were living. And we've got three of the four kittens at our office. And the little girl is the toughest nut of the bunch. And Doug, my husband, has been able to pick her up and has actually gotten her to start purring when she sits in his arms. So we are making progress with those cats.
So a kitten you can deal with. A feral adult is going to be harder to domesticate.
Very, very difficult, unless it really was at one time a domestic cat who's been let loose. We have seen those. And then once they get back inside and trust humans again, they're amazing. But you don't know that when you're getting them.
Right, right. We're talking to Bobby Heller, Executive Director of Felines and Friends. So right now, right before the holidays, you are looking for a lot of things, including foster homes. Tell us about the foster program.
We do not have a shelter. We are what is called a shelterless shelter. And so we rely 100% on foster homes. And many of them have a few too many cats in them, which is not... we're not worried about the health. It's more about giving them the individual attention. And we've
lost... So some very generous-hearted foster mother or father might be fostering five or six cats instead of one or two.
Correct. And, you know, if they have their own pets as well, that makes it difficult. So we've lost a few foster homes because of the holidays. We had some students, and they've gone home for an extended period until school starts up again, college starts up. And we've got other people who, by the nature of economics, have had to take jobs in other cities, and they've moved out of Santa Fe. So we've lost them because of that. So between those two things, we are in desperate need right now of foster homes through into January.
So what makes a good cat foster parent?
Anybody who loves animals and has a spare room, which is a good place to foster, or a bathroom if they don't want them running loose in their house, and really just is willing to give the time and the space for the cat until they find a home.
Yeah, because then you don't know if the cats are going to use your couch as their scratching post.
Well, we do provide scratching posts, and that is part of what fostering is, to train them appropriately, which doesn't take much. Cats do get the picture pretty quickly, and that way they are prepared for a permanent home.
So do you have, is it easy to find permanent homes for cats? It seems like between you and the various animal shelters, there's just a greater supply than demand.
There is a greater supply, and we're all in the same boat. We work closely with the Santa Fe and Española shelters, and we're all having the same problem. There's a lot of owner relinquishing going on because of people having to move, and so many apartments don't allow pets. So it's putting a big strain on all the organizations, and we're a second chance organization, so we take the cats from the shelters that don't do well on display in the shelter.
Oh, boy.
And that takes longer to place those guys.
What makes a cat, less desirable for adoption than another cat?
Well, if you're talking in regards to second chance, it can just be that they freak out. You know, they don't understand why they're there and there's so many other cats, and that's by nature what a shelter has to do.
Right.
They get seen more, which is good, but on the flip side, some of them don't do well in that environment because it's just too traumatic. They don't understand why they've lost their home or how they ended up in, you know, what they perceive as incarceration.
Right.
And, you know, the Santa Fe shelter has a fabulous facility, but the cats don't understand
do.
That. So we pull those guys because they're adoptable. It's just not under those circumstances.
It just, once again, it reminds one that they're an awful lot like us.
Yeah, we don't like being confined.
Yeah,
and staring at your neighbor
through
a glass.
Imagine being taken out of your home and incarcerated in some place with people you don't know.
Right. And, you know, our adoption center is at Petco. and we try to make it as comfortable as possible, but it's not ideal either. I mean, they don't understand why they're there, and there's people and kids screaming, and you know, people bringing their dogs and allowing them to go face to face.
Right.
And those cats could have been a week ago sleeping on somebody's bed.
Right, right. And so some of this is that people have to move into less expensive apartments, and the new apartment doesn't take their kitty?
Correct.
Oh,
or, moving in with family members while they try to find a place, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, right. So economic downturns are hard in so many different ways.
Yes, and the animals do suffer down the trickle-down effect.
I went to Petco the other day and to buy some dog food, and they asked if I wanted to donate a dollar to their foundation. And I thought, well, is that going to go to some corporate headquarters? But I guess it goes to you guys and various other people.
Yeah, the majority of it goes to us because we're the primary organization at Petco. And we just did photos with Santa Claus at Petco, and we will get the benefit of that as well. So we do get a lot of donations. The foundation does support us, thank goodness. And they've just approved us to start getting supplies monthly from the store to give to the animals that are on display. So now we don't have to worry about running out and buying litter and food for the cats that are on display at Petco. They're supporting those guys.
But you do need litter and food for
foster homes.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that people can donate if they want.
Absolutely. We'll take it in any form, whether it be the food and litter itself in the donation bin that we have set up. We'll take gift cards. I'll take them for anywhere. Walmart, Sam's Club, Petco, PetSmart, anything that we can buy supplies, because many of the foster parents are able to give us the space, but they can't afford necessarily the additional mouths to feed because they've already got their own pets.
Right, right. We're talking to Bobby Heller of Felines and Friends. So in addition to that, of course, you will take donations of money because you have not only to feed and maintain these cats, but they've got health issues and you have to pay veterinarians.
Many times, because we're second chance, we take kitties that would need something extra to get them to adoptable shape. They've either got severe upper respiratory, we've had in the past tinea, which is a fungus, skin fungus, and you know, it's curable, but it takes time. And we've had also second chance surgeries, everything from eye removals to limb removals, and those are expensive. And right now our vet bills are running a little over $2,000 a month.
Oh boy.
And we only ask a $100 adoption fee, and many times the cats have cost us far more to rescue and rehabilitate. But they make wonderful pets, and they deserve a second chance.
So let's talk about the you're having a photo opportunity with the actual Santa Claus.
Absolutely.
Here from the North Pole.
Yes, he likes coming to Santa Fe.
Especially in weather like this.
Well, he feels right at home, and apparently Mrs. Claus likes the shopping here, so we are going to be, this is the
shop
last chance.
Local.
Shop local. By art. So we're at PetSmart over in Zafferano this coming Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 4. We get $5 from each of the photos that are taken. We're doing them digital. They will be printed out on the spot. You get a nice frame.
So you can have yourself or your child and your pet in a picture with Santa?
Yes. This past weekend we were doing it, and we actually had somebody come in. They don't have any pets yet, but they had a two-month-old baby, and so we took the photo with Santa and the baby, and that was really, really cute.
So there's also a raffle for a 36-inch Sony TV. There's raffle tickets happening. Is that at the same place at PetSmart?
We are making the tickets available at the photo shoot, but they can also be bought online through our link and PayPal that's on our website, and also during our adoption hours at Petco, which is 1 to 4, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. It's every week. And whoever,
so don't get those mixed up. PetSmart is down across from the Target at Zafferano. And Petco is near Hobby Lobby on the corner of St. Mike's and Cerritos.
Correct. And Petco is our official home, as it were, and that's where we will be selling the majority of the tickets. And we're only selling 100 tickets. So it's 1 in 100 chance of winning a big TV.
And there's also a cat condo that is being raffled off.
Yes, and it's beautiful. It's
what's a cat condo?
Well, it includes areas for them to scratch. They don't scratch the furniture, and places for them to lounge around and look
out
the window.
It's like a house?
sort of like a glorified scratching post, but it has platforms and a little sort of a hutch on top where they can cuddle up and go to sleep.
And if there's more than one, is there a place for them to have condo association meetings?
Probably, but you'd need another condo. Which we'll raffle off again next year.
So all of this is what's happening with Felines and Friends. You're doing incredible work. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners in Santa Fe to know?
Well, if you've got space in your home and hearts for either a temporary or a permanent cat or kitten, we could certainly use the help and would love to hear from you. We do have our adoption advisors at Petco every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 1 to 4. We're always looking for additional volunteers to help man those adoption hours or clean the cages and play with the kitties. We need people to help transport.
So if somebody wants to just go over and play with kitties, that is a job that needs to be done.
It is a job that needs to be done. You do have to poop a scoop while you're there, though. So there is the dirty side of the job.
It's not that bad.
No, it's not.
One more question. If somebody has a dog, now if you, as I've said on the show before, if you have Jack Russell Terriers, just don't even think about getting a cat. But if you have a dog and you're thinking about getting a cat and it's not a Jack Russell Terrier, what's some advice for people introducing a cat into a dog household?
The big thing is that dogs, their social networking is done by immediately going up to the other dog and sniffing. A cat finds this incredibly offensive. So you need to keep them separated where the cat can have its own space. And the worst that people can do is bring a cat home and let it loose in the house, because it's not going to like this unknown dog just, you know, confronting it. Quite often putting a kitty gate across a door and giving the cat a safe space, then the cat will come out when it's ready because it's sized up the situation. And that's really the difference. A cat will size up its environment and its situation, whereas a dog will just bolt. It's sort of like, you know, they're not looking before they leap.
Right, right. The gregarious as opposed to the reserved.
Right. And we do many placements with mixed households where there's a dog, and we have foster homes with dogs, and so we know which cats actually do well with the dogs.
Bobby, what is the website and phone number for Felines and Friends?
The phone number is 316-2281.
That's which is 316-CAT-1.
Yes, it is, CAT-1. And the email is askfelinesandfriends@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And we have a website as well that is felinesandfriends.org. When you go to that site, there is a link to the New Mexico chapter. Otherwise, you're looking at what's happening in California.
Right, right. Well, Bobby Heller, Executive Director of Felines and Friends, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break right now. We will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Pal Dibel. She is the director of Arsenic and Old Lace, which is happening at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. Hello.
Great to have you. So the Arsenic and Old Lace, probably many of us know as a movie from 1944 with Cary Grant and Peter Lorre and all sorts of people.
Yes.
You've adapted it to actually take place in Santa Fe.
I have.
Tell us more about that.
Mortimer Still is a drama critic in New York, but he's coming home to spend Christmas, Santa Fe Christmas, with his aunties. And everything is pretty much the same, except it's present day. And the aunties are still have their charities killing old elderly gentlemen.
Now, their charity is killing elderly, lonely elderly gentlemen.
Lonely.
Why is that charity in their twisted little poisonous minds?
Well, because they're very wealthy people, and they live in the stage is set as a very wealthy adobe with eclectic art and paintings, and so they have all this time and energy, so they're just, you know, they're Methodists, and they just want to help people, and they find that that's the easiest thing for them to do is to rid them of their loneliness and to have a proper burial and to people put flowers on their grave. So it's really funny.
So they hide them in the movie they hide them in the basement.
Well, in the Panama Canal, yes, the cellar. Uh-huh. They dig locks for the Panama. Well, Teddy Roosevelt digs locks for these dead bodies.
Now, Teddy Roosevelt is a crazy relative of theirs who thinks he's Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And he's very funny. It's played by David McConnell.
So
McConnell, excuse me.
The film, as I remember it, it's one of those sort of funny combinations of slapstick and scary movie.
Right.
So you have to really maintain that tension of comedy and suspense. Mm-hmm. How do you do that when you're making a play?
I do that. And when the curtain opens or the lights go up, it starts very, it's a very funny play because Kesselring is a very good writer and he's timeless. So basically it's a lot of physicality. Of course, we have our dead bodies, Mr. Spinozel, and also Mr. Hushkins. So the children love it, too. So there are a lot of children coming to see the show.
Oh, it's a family movie. And it's already opened.
Yes, it opened last weekend, and we did quite well. And we had a standing ovation, and things are going well. But it's an all-family PG-rated, well, G-rated for the family. But yes, it's written so well that the play just moves along, and I have such a strong, talented cast that it's very funny, very, very funny, because each of the characters are so unique and individual that it just keeps you interested. It's very entertaining.
So Joseph Kesselring was the playwright. Was this a stage play before it was the Cary Grant movie?
Yes, 80 years ago he wrote it.
80 years ago?
It's pretty timeless. So.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Because the themes are crazy relatives, life, death, and wackiness, which really don't go out of style.
Never, never. And I thought, I'm actually from Chicago, but I think Santa Fe is the perfect community to have updated this play. Because of the uniqueness of the people here, and everyone's open, and many religions and different things. And
our share of eccentrics.
Yes, our large share of eccentrics.
Like the man walking into the cafe now with a green parrot in his hand.
Oh, my God, you're right. Hey!
This is public radio, KSFR Broadcasting.
That's
from the
right.
Santa Fe Baking Company. Yes, yes, ladies and gentlemen.
That's an African parrot, too, if I may point that out. A lovely bird. But I guess it is my day. So
we're talking to Pal Dybel again about Arsenic and Old Lace, which is being performed at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and it'll be there actually for quite a while. It goes through Christmas and into the new year.
Yes, January 4th is our last show. Mm-hmm.
So tell us more about yourself. You've been here for a bit. You've been here in Santa Fe for
yes,
a while.
Yes, I've been here a couple of years. I was actually a filmmaker in Chicago, and I had produced a sci-fi feature film, which I sold, won a couple awards at the festivals and everything. So I wanted to reestablish myself in a new community.
A sci-fi feature film.
Yes, called Changing Man, yes. Uh-huh. It was 350 actors and 40 Chicago locations.
Good heavens.
So, yeah, it was quite a production. So I wanted to establish myself in Santa Fe, and that's why I started doing plays. I did three of the bench warmer plays at the Santa Fe Playhouse, which is coming up again, and I will be doing a couple of those also again. So basically, my background is in filmmaking, and of course, you know, we all grow up doing plays and acting and things like that. So yeah, it's
and
really
some
nice.
Of us keep do some of you keep doing
keep
it.
Keep doing it. That's right. Absolutely.
Now in the movie, and again, I saw the movie a long time ago, but I was rewatching. There's so many snippets of it on YouTube that aren't in order. That if you can sort of almost watch the whole thing,
you
but
can.
Not in the right order. You piece it together in your head. But there's a character who's one of the nephews of these crazy murderous aunts, who is also a murderous type himself, who looks like Boris Karloff.
Jonathan.
Frankenstein monster.
Jonathan Brewster. And that's played by Dr. Paul Walski. And he's quite scary. Quite scary. And he's very, very good in it. So, yeah, he plays wonderful. And also I have playing Dr. Einstein is Hugh Elliott, who is a local, very talented actor who does a lot of film work. He's quite well known.
And that was the Peter Lorre character.
Hey, Johnny. So it's very, very funny. And there are just so many bits, you know, that you just sit there and laugh. And because I've updated it, and I don't want to give it away, okay?
Right, right.
But people have come up to me after the show and said, wow, we really like what you did. That was so funny about this and so funny about that. So I think it's working. So I'm happy.
So do you use scary music in it?
Yes, we do. A little scary music. Uh-huh. Absolutely. So, yeah, we keep a lot of the scenes are done in the dark with candlelights and just a cellar door open. There's suspense. One thing wonderful about this play, it's a three-act play, And it runs for 2.5 hours, including 2 10-minute intermissions. And this
That's a long play.
But it really moves for three acts, I'll tell you. You're not going to sit there going ho-hum. I mean, you're always thinking what's going to happen because we're always throwing bits of new information to you and going on and on and on. And that's fun, you know. You can just sit back and relax and enjoy yourself and just laugh.
And the character of Mortimer is just hopelessly naive, but a very pleasant sort of heroic type.
Yes, he's so full of himself, and that's played by Hardy Morris Pinnell. And he is superb, and he does a lot of stunts and different things that are kind of exciting to watch. It's quite lovely. I mean, he's just amazing.
So Arsenic and Old Lace is at the Santa Fe Playhouse. We can't talk about how much prices are, but it's playing on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for the next several weekends.
And Sunday.
So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 o'clock, and then Sundays at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Thursdays are a pay what you wish.
Yes,
this,
they are.
This Thursday, anyway.
All the Thursdays are always at the Playhouse pay what you wish.
Okay.
And except then if they have an opening night gala, then it's a different price. But also, since our play runs on Christmas and on...
On Christmas Day?
Yes, and on New Year's, we're dark those days. And we have, it's called a Twilight Matinee on Saturday, the following
Saturday.
So you're not,
it's not going to run on Christmas.
No, it's a Twilight Matinee, which is at 4, and then we go into our evening performance at 8. They call it the Twilight Matinee, which is kind of cool.
And people can find out more at SantaFePlayhouse.org.
Yes, they can.
And do you know the phone number over there? We will find that out and put it on our website, ladies and gentlemen, the number at the Santa Fe Playhouse.
You can buy the tickets online, and what you do, you go to SantaFePlayhouse.org, and you order the tickets, and then you show up at the box office, and you pay for them then. So they're not taking credit cards online, but they will take a reservation. It's the honor system. And
Pal Diebel is the, here's the number, 988-4262. Takes
Sorry.
A moment. 988-4262 is the number of the Santa Fe Playhouse. Anything you want to let our listeners know before we go?
Well, I'd just like to tell them that I don't think they'll be disappointed. And if you want, and if the relatives are in town and you want some place to take them after a nice dinner somewhere in one of our wonderful restaurants, or before I should say dinner, it's a wonderful, wonderful show. It's just a happy show, and you leave feeling good.
Despite all the dead bodies.
Yes, despite all the dead bodies. You leave feeling really good. So it's very humorous, and like I said, you'll start laughing from the moment you arrive to the very end. So I hope people will come out and support the theater. It is non-for-profit. The actors do not get paid. So it's very nice if you can come out and support us.
Well, it's great to have you, and we look forward to Arsenic and Old Lace, those who haven't seen it yet, and to the Benchwarmers and future productions that you're involved with at the Santa Fe Playhouse.
Yes, thank you very much.
Pal Diebel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Arthur Ian. He is the director of the documentary film Looking for Romeo, which screens this Friday night, December 19th at 8:15 at the Santa Fe Film Center. It's part of Queer Night in Santa Fe. And he will actually be here talking about the film and doing questions and answers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So this is a very interesting and moving documentary film about male prostitutes. How did you come to make this film?
Everybody certainly wants to know that. When I worked in Europe every summer for a long time in Nice, I came to see groups of teenagers from Eastern Europe, namely from Romania. Some of them look 14, 15-year-old kids who were soliciting clients in one of the parts of neighborhoods of Nice. And it took me a few weeks of observing that to finally understand what's happening, and I was really shocked by that. I was also very shocked by the fact that it seems to be so widely accepted. It's not even a big deal. I mean, you could literally see a group of 15 to 20 kids standing by the road, waiting, waving to cars, being picked up and dropped off. And to me, it was very shocking. So after a while, I started talking to them, which was very difficult. Obviously, they were very, very nervous. And I didn't speak any Romanian, they didn't speak any English or French, so we used broken Italian or broken French to communicate. And after a while, I started interviewing them. And then I found myself really interested in the subject, and after I showed my first footage to my friends in Los Angeles, they suggested developing it further.
I can imagine that they were nervous talking to you and that they would be even more nervous agreeing to be in a film like that. How did you earn their trust so that they wanted to be in a film?
Well, I think because it was my first film and because I was so unintimidating, I didn't have a crew. I had to film everything by myself and my camera skills were very rudimentary. It was also a very unsafe part of Nice. These guys were attacked right in front of me by people of Muslim background who were less tolerant than others towards gay kids. So this was a very unsafe neighborhood to be in. On top of that, I had to film using a camera I didn't really know very well and interpret from one language to another. So it was very, very difficult. I think after a while I just earned their trust, and I really cared for them. I tried to help them. One of them actually even wanted to be a student in the United States. He really hated doing that and wanted to get out of it. They were very desperate, and I helped them. I even bought them food. I mean, before I left, we had a pizza party. But later on, they actually withdrew their consent, so I did not use them in the film. Most of the film, as it is right now, almost all of it, is based on interviews in Los Angeles. This was much easier to do. There was no language barrier. I could use a professional cameraman for most of it. And it wasn't easy either, to get people in Los Angeles to talk about something like this. And I went even one step further and actually got to talk to people who hire escorts and try to understand why they do that. So you have two sides of the story. One is told by the escorts and another one by their clients.
And that's a very important part of it. And I would think that the, again, getting people who are clients of these young men to be on film, I mean, there's shame on both sides of it. Again, how did you earn their trust? How did you even find them?
It was extremely difficult. Most of this was done by me searching online for people who do this sort of thing. For every 100 people I asked, about 5 agreed initially to meet me, and I think about 1 out of 5 would even agree to be on camera. It was very, very difficult. It took a year and a half of searching and trying to set something like this up. It's funny detail, a couple of times I was propositioned, in return for their agreement to be in the film. So it was very, very difficult. Sometimes people would start working with me and start talking to me, and then they would disappear. So then everything was wasted. I had to start back from scratch. A lot of times people try to blackmail me in return for their interviews. It was a very interesting excursion into human nature. But I must say, for me, my perception of it changed, really, really dramatically changed. I mean, when I first approached the subject, I had this sacrosanct fear, of what is it that I'm dealing with here? Who am I talking to? How can these people do this? After a while, though, you start seeing the human side of it, and you start to see how they came to these circumstances. And the picture is much more diverse than you would have thought in the first place. So, in a way, I evolved myself by making this film. And in the film, I try not to impose my opinion on the viewer. I let the characters tell their story and tell their side of the story.
We're talking to Arthur Ian about his documentary film, Looking for Romeo. I think the film really is a great example of how, for the audience, for the person watching it, it's very hard to be judgmental about somebody once you know their story. There's a lot of pain and abuse in the lives of these young men who go into this line of work, and there's one especially heartbreaking young man named Bobby in the film. You explore this complicated relationship between their lives and the work they're doing. I mean, without giving away the film completely, can you tell us a little bit about what led some of these young men to prostitution?
Well, it's a very important question. It's a central question, and that's what many people ask me. Well, in the end, what is it? I had to conclude that there is really no one single explanation. In many cases, you see child abuse. In the case of Bobby, there was child abuse. Drugs, really people who were broken early on in their lives and they had to resort to this. In many cases, you see desperation. In many cases, they don't seem as desperate at all. They seem fine with it. They look at it as a business. They make money and they leave it. There is a very complex picture. I must say a lot of people who were in the film later left escorting. And I took them out of the film. I had to focus the film on some central characters. But the way they come to this, the different paths that they take to doing this job, they are very diverse. And some of them, continue doing it. Some of them stop doing it. And there's one guy who, after meeting me in this film, moved back with his parents and restarted his previous career, and he's still in touch with me. And we actually became good friends. So it's a very, very complex and diverse picture. Like I said, some of them, it's desperation. Some of them, it's abuse. Some of them, economic difficulty. Some of them, drugs. Some of them don't seem to mind this as much, although, you know, they probably realize that they can't keep doing this for a long time. And on the side of the clients also, a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different paths people take to this. Loneliness, one of them, you know, feeling like they're old and not wanted by anyone, rejection. So if, for me, it was just a very interesting case study, basically, on human nature, on human morality. How do we reason about what we do in life? How do we moralize? How do we build our values? How much of them are we ready to give up or sacrifice when times are really, really tough? And it's a really tough test, I think.
One of the people, I think the one you were perhaps referring to a moment ago, was a classically trained dancer, highly intelligent,
yes.
And very, very educated, attractive man. And he had injuries that made him no longer able to dance. And,
yes.
And you know, so he's presented with a choice of juggling three or four low-wage jobs or
yes.
doing this very well-paid job. And that is a trade-off that when, you know, you, the viewer watching the film, start thinking about it, it's tricky business.
It's very tricky business. By the way, that's the young man that left escorting
right,
and went
right.
back. And I can tell you, and I can tell the audience right now, he is on a tour. He's touring Korea and Japan as a part of a dance troupe, and he's back on track, and he's, you know, back in dancing. He has a partner now. He lives with his family, so things are back on track for him. But, yes, this was one of the harder cases in the film. He's a very good-looking, very smart guy. He is the one who says how much it really takes away a part of his soul and how much it affects him doing that. I actually remembered him many times, you know, living in Los Angeles and having my own life experiences. He had some really interesting things to say about how the city can actually cripple a person and how people sometimes are cannibalistic. That's his quote, actually. He says stronger ones kind of pick on weaker ones. For me, one of the interesting conclusions in the film is that we're so quick to condemn people who sell themselves, you know, physically. But a lot of people sell themselves or other people in many other ways and actually inflict much more harm on each other, and they sell each other for a very, very high price, much higher than $50 an hour or $100 an hour. So for me, it's the philosophical puzzle that's interesting here.
Let's talk a little bit about the business. How do they, I mean, you talked about people in Europe just being on the streets and being picked up and so on, but there's also an internet component
yes.
to this business. Tell us about that.
Well, I think most of this business now takes place online. I think it's much more convenient. It's there are several sites that are created specifically for this sort of thing. A lot of online dating services, online chat services. You can see this everywhere. These kids in France, they were in the street because they didn't have access to the internet, and they couldn't do it. They just didn't have the means. They were really literally in the street, so they could not access it. But I guess at a more quote-unquote sophisticated level, this takes place online. It's a cleaner and more convenient way to do it. And nowadays, actually, you see more and more of it. Unfortunately, people are getting more and more desperate these days with the economic situation. So I've actually noticed myself an increase in ads for these kind of services.
And as one of the men in your film talks about, it's a little bit disconcerting, or more than a little bit disconcerting, to know that people are shopping for you the way they could shop for any sort of product. They want a 6-foot, blonde-haired, blue-eyed...
Yeah, it's like a catalog. That's what he says, right? It's like a
right.
catalog. You can pick what you want. That is true. You know, this is where I kind of disagree with some of my characters in the film and some people who watched the film and said, you know, in the end, it's just business. I don't think it's just business. I think that there is something to human dignity and the dignity of human body. And I don't think people are meat. I don't think people should be bought or sold, even for an hour or 2 hours. For me, it's really kind of like temporary slavery, you know, and I don't think this is dignifying for either party. So I do have this opinion, although, as you probably noticed, I do not impose it on the viewer, and there are many other opinions expressed about this. Most of my characters actually think that it's okay, it's no big deal, it's just another job. I don't agree with that, but I let the viewer make the call.
Some of them don't either. I mean, there are some of them who talk about the pain of it, the potential and real violence of it, and that sense, as one said, about selling his soul. It doesn't seem like if they could make that kind of money working a different job that they wouldn't choose to do something else.
I agree with you. I think so. Again, I don't think this goes without consequences. I don't think you can just turn off your mind and basically be used as an object for a little bit and then go back to being who you are. I think it's deeply traumatizing. I think it leaves scars on one's consciousness, on one's soul, and I don't think people should be treated like objects, should be treated like meat, pretty much. I think it belittles people. I think it belittles intimacy, physical intimacy and romantic intimacy. I frankly don't like it. So this is how, it's kind of ironic that I ended up doing a film on this subject, because I am very, very conservative, I suppose, in my views. But this is why I was so shocked initially seeing this in France, that people think it's no big deal. It's an everyday occurrence, you know, 15-year-old, 16-year-old kid being picked up to be used and then dropped back where he was. For me, it also raises some questions kind of bordering on child abuse. You know, this is not something I was going to treat lightly. So it's kind of ironic that I came to do this film.
We're talking to Arthur Ian, the director of the film Looking for Romeo, which is screening in Santa Fe on December 18th and 19th at the Santa Fe Film Center. The question does arise, I mean, in the context of what you were just speaking about, whether these men are still able to love and believe in love. It seems like that's a hope that most people still carry, and that no matter what their life situation is, it's a hope that really dies hard.
A lot of them actually do admit that it takes away from their ability to have a real meaningful romantic connection to someone, a meaningful physical connection to someone. I certainly think so. With some of their stories, you can see that they resort to this as a substitute for real love or real relationship with someone, and I don't think it works. I think it only makes it more and more difficult for them to have something real, to have something meaningful. Basically, it's kind of, I would say, like a drug. It's a drug that you take when you really feel sad or dissatisfied with yourself or lonely and incapable of finding something real. And actually, I am in touch with a lot of these characters now. Some of them, like I said, stopped doing this. Some of them are doing worse than they were before. But in very, very few cases do I see someone who is, you know, still happy doing this on either side, it being an escort or a client. For me, it's really kind of like a drug. It's a substitute for something that, unfortunately, these people haven't found yet.
I would think that being in the film, whether it be escort or client, affected the people who were in it. Have any of them seen the film, the finished version?
They haven't, but some of them, actually, you're quite right, they have been affected by it. Just by talking to me about it, a lot of them said that this was like therapy to them. Just talking to someone about it, seeing this from a third person's viewpoint, but also just vocalizing it, just speaking to me about this, actually helped them. It was very beneficial to them. They actually wanted to meet me more, wanted to talk to me more. So without having any qualifications of a psychologist, I maybe helped them a little bit. And they're still in touch with me. And sometimes when they need help or they need to talk to someone, they still get in touch with me.
Arthur Ian, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Arthur Ian is the director of Looking for Romeo. You can find out more about it on the web at lookingforromeo.com. And he will be here on Friday, December 19th at 8:15 in the evening. It's Queer Night at the Santa Fe Film Center. And you can find out more about the Film Center by looking at santafefilmfestival.com or calling 988-7414. Arthur Ian, we look forward to meeting you when you're here in Santa Fe.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And it is screening with a couple of other films, Sweat, which is a film from the UK, and
yes,
Angels in the Night, which is a German film.
All right. Well, it was a real pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Sleem. She is the director of the Solstice Cabaret Show, which is happening this Saturday, December 20th, at 7 o'clock at the Engine House Theater in Madrid, New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for calling me. Appreciate it.
So this is a variety show that's taking place in Madrid, a Solstice Cabaret. Tell us about it. You are a performer who is taking a number of roles.
Yeah, I'm a performer, and I usually do clowning and emceeing, and this summer I've been producing more shows, which is rather good. And so we decided to put something on for Christmas, and just pulling together and putting out a casting call and seeing what came back. And we have a pretty mixed variety of acts coming on.
So tell us about some of the acts that are coming on the Solstice Cabaret Show.
We have a band called Indigy Femme. I haven't actually met them before, but they come highly recommended, and they have a pretty good following. And there's going to be four of them coming on stage. There's going to be dance from Kelly McDowell in Santa Fe. I'm going to be doing some clown magic and mind reading, and I'll also be hosting it. And then we also have Chicks with Chainsaws.
Chicks with Chainsaws, what's that?
Chicks with Chainsaws is this Madrid-based local sort of a drag acrobatic dance performance troupe. And they've done, I'm part of it, and so far we have performed twice and done two different pieces, and we're going to do two new pieces in this show.
So I hear that Santa Claus will actually also be there, is that correct?
From Yeah, Santa Claus will be there, from the North Pole? It's going to be a bit more of a adolescent teenage boy slim down Santa.
Yes.
A bit baggy, should we say.
Santa Junior.
Yes, yes. With a bit of an attitude. We're calling this more of an adult show. Quite often I do shows that are all ages, but this time we wanted a little more verbal freedom to say whatever comes to mind.
So don't bring the elementary school kids.
No, not this time. 2 weeks ago we did a kids' talent show. That was the kids' version.
You actually have studied professional clowning. What is that like to study to be a clown? What do you learn when you're learning to be a clown?
Well, I didn't really know when I showed up. I auditioned. It's a 1-year professional clown school in San Francisco, and it's full time from September through June. And 5 days a week we do. In the mornings we do mostly acrobatics, circus skills like juggling, rollerballer, stilt walking, and the such. And then in the afternoon, we do specific clown routines and about the history and the culture of clowning and the different contexts and how to do what we do.
What is the history of clowning? How far back does clowning go?
It goes back in many cultures to many hundreds of years ago, if not. There's always been someone that plays the fool, that lightens things up or makes a parody, whether through physical humor or verbal humor, of what the current situation is. So I tend to go more these days for the verbal humor, more the English dry wit, and I like to give myself complete freedom with that, which is a lot of fun, but mostly what the school was focused on was more of the circus aspects. So I'm more vaudeville, and that was more circus.
In the circus aspect, the clown basically doesn't talk.
No, it depends on the circus, though. The American circus is, or has become in the last century, so huge that as the circuses got bigger and the audiences got further away, the clowns talked less and less. But in the old school traveling circus, where it was more of a one-ring mud circus, then there was a lot more verbal humor involved.
So, Sleem is the director of the Solstice Cabaret Show, which is happening in Madrid, New Mexico, at the Engine House Theater, and it's at 7 o'clock on
Saturday the 20th.
Saturday the 20th, and is there a phone number if people want to come down and get tickets and so on?
We don't need to do reservations. We're just having people come on the door and pay at the door, but the phone number would be through the Mineshaft Tavern in Madrid.
So people can call the Mineshaft.
They can call to confirm and get details if they want.
And so you're going to be doing quite a bit of theater there in coming months.
Yeah, actually, I'm putting on another show at the Engine House Theater on January the 24th, and it's going to be a solo vaudeville show, and it's all me. I'll be doing magic, clowning, singing, lots of storytelling, some drag, some different comic personas. It's going to be a one-hour solo show, which is quite a challenge.
Well,
so I'm working on that as well.
Amazing. Excellent. Well, we look forward to that, and we look forward to seeing you at the Solstice Cabaret Show. Sling.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Not at all.
Bye-bye.
So you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.